This is Dr. Richard Verone. I am conducting an oral history interview on September 25th, 2002 with Mr. Nguyen Xuong Phuong. And we are in the Special Collections Library on the Texas Tech campus in Lubbock, Texas. Phuong, would you like to start with some thoughts and discussion about your childhood and where you grew up in Vietnam, where you were born, and so forth?
Well, that would be very difficult to remember everything.
Of course.
But the things that I can remember when I was very young was that at that time we were in the very deep south of Vietnam, in the peninsula, the point of the peninsula in the Cà Mau area, that is very deep south. And my father was at that time responsible for the building of roads and bridges. He remained in that area for over 20 years. And most of the time, as I remember, we were on sampans, living in tents along the roadside, in the marshes. They have lots of swamps there. And that was a kind of, the early shambles. But I was born in the village of Vinh Lai, of the province of Bạc Liêu. And Bạc Liêu was also the name of the provincial town there. So I think as far back as I can remember, it was probably about 3 or 4 years old. And our house was at that time just beside a girls' school. And for some unknown reason, I was allowed to attend the girls' school. Not even a kind of first grade. I was the only one there when I was about 3 or 4 years old, and you must be about 5 or 6 years old to be admitted in that school. And it was completely a girls' school, so I was the only boy, about 3.5, 4 years old at that time, to attend that girls' school. So that's how I began my schooling.
Why did your parents send you there? Do you know why they?
Because just beside the house,
just right there,
and I could make a hole in the fence, between our house and the school. I made a dog hole there, and I went to school through the hole instead of going round in the street.
And the teachers and the other students were okay with that?
Oh yes, I was very special. I was put at the back of the classroom, I did what I wanted, with my pencils and paper, because I was not able to attend the class, not big enough. But there was an incident there, because one time there was a visit by the general inspector of the schools of Indochina. So he was a French high official. And I was told that when asked how old, I was, I must say in French, j'ai 5 ans, I am 5, because it's the age that you are admitted, to the school. But then I forgot completely. And when the great man came and asked me how old I was, I said, 3 ans et demi, 3.5. And he said, go home right away.
And did you?
Well, I pretend to go home because the next day he was off. He was no longer there, and I returned to school, of course.
That's right.
So that was the incident that I remember. That far. And so we remained there until the Japanese came. So that was the French colonial rule. And we had to study French, at that time. That is, all the kids there had to learn that our ancestors were the Gauls with blonde hair. That was now. So all the Vietnamese had to learn that history lesson.
Right. How many brothers and sisters did you have?
Well, my parents had altogether 5. So I have a sister, the eldest, who's now 81.
Okay.
And then there was another sister, and then another brother. But the second and the third then died when they were very young, about 3 or 4 years old, when my father was down there building the roads. And then they died of dysentery. So
both of them?
Because they ate something. Both of them within 5 days. Mm. And then later on, I mean, they, there was another brother, mm-hmm. and me, the last one. So the other brother also is now in France, and he was with our national air carrier airline, the Amman Airline, for 20 years, from 1956 to 1975. And he was the last executive director of Vietnam Airlines. And he took about 9 years of education in North Vietnam too. So he's now living in France with his children and grandchildren.
Okay. Can you tell me about your parents? What do you remember about them in your youth?
Well, probably like most kids, really. We had the impression that they were there, but we didn't know much about what they were, really. But I knew that my father was a civil engineer, building roads and bridges. He built thousands of miles of roads and hundreds of bridges in that southern part of Vietnam for mm-hmm. over 20, 30 years. And my mother, she barely finished elementary education in her native village, but she was extremely intelligent, you know, very, very logic in her thinking. She took care of everything, but my father was not very good for, you know, family affairs, and he was most of the time in the roads. And so I always had the impression that my father was very, a very kind man, mm-hmm. and he was open and very ready to listen to other people's views, and he didn't try anything very grandiose. Mm-hmm. For him, life was very simple, and he did his job. My mother was a very good housewife. That was my impression.
Okay. So your father was, he was gone a lot, working on the roads. He was not at home a lot?
Most of the time, yes, he was on the road. Okay. But later on, when he was promoted to be the chief of the public works and so on, then he had more of a desk job. Okay. But he liked to be in the fields rather than sit at the desk.
Right.
Yes. So altogether, he had about 47 years in the public service, just in the public works.
Okay. Yeah. And so he's working for the French? And
well, he worked for the French.
And then the Japanese.
And then there was the Japanese, no, because Japanese did not stay there very long. Mm-hmm. But then afterwards, for even the Viet Minh, for a while, when they were there. And then the return of the French. That is the French of the Gaulle, after the Pétain, French. And then afterwards it was Bao Dai, and then Diem, you see, and so on. He went through all kinds of political regimes. It did not bother him at all.
Okay, he was,
he was
just did his job.
Apolitical, completely.
Okay. And was your mother, was she also apolitical? Or
completely, even more.
Okay, okay.
But I must tell you an anecdote here, because my brother, my father had a very dear friend, and that was engineer Bich, his name was. He was a French trained civil engineer from Polytechnic School, that is the crack school in Paris of civil engineering. Mm-hmm. They were very close. And at one time, after the return of the French, the Second World War, and my father was then on the side mm-hmm. of the non-communists. Mm-hmm. But the engineer Bit was on the Berman side still, I think.
Okay.
But often they met in the evenings, either at engineer Bit's place or at my our home. And then the two discuss ways how to blow up bridges and how to repair them. You know? And so Bit would say, I will you know, blow up your bridge as a V. My father said, that would take me 3 days, you know, to get it up. He said that in that case, I'd do with a W. My father said, 6 days then. Things like that. It went on for years like that.
Interesting, interesting. Well, can you tell me about your village that you grew up in?
Oh, the village, rather, it would be the villages of my parents. So I was born in deep south, near the Bakliu Kamau area. Bakliu, which is now called the Minhai province, M-I-N-H-H-I-A-I. But my parents are both from, were both from the Bentre province.
Okay.
That means the Mekong area. And Bentre province has always been known as the home of the uprising in the south against the French and so on. So they were both there, but the story of my parents was also quite amusing, because my father got scholarships through the French system to become a technical agent in public works. And when he graduated as a technical agent, he went home and he was about 24 years old at that time. But in our native villages, the families had made arrangements for them to get married, as traditional customs require. And he was supposed to go to my mother's village, it's about 30 miles away, to have a look at his future bride. And that day he forgot. So he took the country bus the following day. And when he arrived there, my maternal grandfather said, well, we waited for you the whole day yesterday. You didn't come. But then in the afternoon, there was a whole official delegation that came here and recommended by the French provincial chief, introducing kind of a deputy, provincial deputy, very powerful man, rich too, who expressed the desire to marry my eldest daughter, because my grandfather had three daughters, 19, 17, and 15. So yesterday, with that powerful delegation, I couldn't say no. So I gave your bride, your future bride, to the deputy. So she's gone. So I say, my father said that that's very awkward, because the family, you know, had made arrangements. And what would I say to my parents now? You see? So my maternal grandfather said, well, I still have two more girls, but the next one is only 17. So would you agree? You know, I can give you the second one. My father said, if that possible, that would, you know, solve the problem.
Mm-hmm.
So that's how he married my mother.
Oh my gosh. Wow.
And they lived for 70 years together.
So it
was 1 month before he died, my father celebrated with my mother the 70th wedding anniversary, 1990.
Wow.
There you are.
That's
she was barely 17.
What has your mother said about that story?
Oh, well, she just, you know, obeyed her father, and that's
right.
It.
No question.
Yeah, and then they had the wedding, and both of them went to Saigon. But he was 24, she was 17 in some months. And they started their life there.
In Saigon?
In Saigon.
Okay.
To start the whole thing.
And so eventually they moved back.
No, and then they went to the deep south, because they were, my father was assigned to that area for building up the roads and bridges, and stayed there for over 20 years.
Okay.
So after the Second World War, and the return of the French, and so on, then eventually end up in Saigon with the Ministry of Public Works.
Okay. What do you remember about, as a young child, about the French?
Well, I don't think that many of us pay them much attention. So here you have to try and understand what kind of people, you know, were involved under the French colonial rule. The French were very clever, you know, not to touch what we call the Council of Notables. That is, say, that Council of Notables was there for centuries. It was composed of 12 officials and then a village chief. And it was very well organized. You have one responsible for the birth and death registry, one for education, one for agriculture, and so on and so forth. One for security, which is the local policeman, and so on and so forth.
Right.
And so they operated on the basis of, you know, spontaneous consent mm-hmm. of the villagers, with all those families living there, you know, for generations. Mm-hmm. Everybody knew everybody.
Right.
And so they considered that elder was good to be the village chief, and he became the village chief. So you have direct democracy there.
Right.
And the French didn't touch that at all, at that grassroots democracy. That's how it operated. And in Bentre, in my maternal native village of Bati, mm-hmm. They were known to be very hardheads, you know. That is to say, when they were not happy with the local government there, that is the village chief and so on, and they went to the imperial court of Hue to complain. Wow. And there was an old guy from Bati village mm-hmm. who walked, you know.
Who walked to Hue?
Yeah. 300 miles
wow.
to Hue to complain to the emperor, the king, at that time that he was unjustly treated in his village.
Wow.
So that was very well-known story in Vietnamese history.
Yeah.
And so that's why Ben Tre province were also known for, you know, the seat of insurgency, of, you know, complaints and opposition mm-hmm. to oppression. Mm-hmm. So during that French colonial period, mm-hmm. they maintained exactly the same thing at the grassroots. And the French presence was felt only from the district level by the presence of a provincial chief, who was a French mm-hmm. official, who had then the control of the district chiefs. But then from the district chief down mm-hmm. to the villages, the hamlets, there was no French presence. Nothing at all. So my maternal grandfather, who was kind of village chief, didn't have any contact with the French. And then he tried to manage his village, thinking that that's just 100% Vietnamese.
Right.
And so the presence of the French colonists were on another plane. And then you have, of course, a segment of the Vietnamese society at that time, and mostly the Pratt land owners. Mm-hmm. So they cooperated with the French authorities. You know. Mm-hmm. They had to pay their dimes to the French authorities.
Right.
And that is how the French authorities managed to exploit, you know, the resources of Vietnam. And eventually they went into the rubber plantations and plantations. But the basic commodity, rice, were then done by the large majority of the Vietnamese mm-hmm. without any knowledge of the French at all.
Right.
Mm-hmm. Through first the small land owners mm-hmm. who literally share the hard life of the farm hands. Mm-hmm. You see? And then they were under the how do you call it, exploitation of the larger land owners.
Right.
Then they had their deals with the French authorities. You see. So those very poor farm hands, that would be about 80% of the Vietnamese population mm-hmm. in the rural areas, continue as they had been doing for centuries. And that was the situation. Now, besides the large landowners, you have a kind of intelligentsia. The Vietnamese who were able to have relation with the French authorities, that would be in the cities. So the cities, you have the beginning of a kind of workers' movement.
Right.
Because you have factories, the French, they have set up lots of factories.
Right.
And then you have the beginning of that, what you now refer to as the proletariat. Mm-hmm. So that is literally, you know, imported from the West.
Yeah.
Because we were, you know, entirely agricultural. There was no industry
right.
in Vietnam during that time. So that is the beginning of the contact with the West, the beginning to have Western values coming in. So you have a kind of intelligentsia, and you have many of the big families in Vietnam, and mostly landowners. And then you have also people who managed to become, you know, well-known professors, intellectuals, and so on. Went to France to study those things.
Right.
And then you have that kind of intelligentsia. But the large majority of people were just peasants in the countryside, unaware of anything. But there was a feeling of peace. There was no war.
Right.
Life was hard, probably much harder in the north and central part of Vietnam. Mm-hmm. But in the south, you know, with the paddy fields and so on, and they can catch their fish and frogs and snails, they can survive easily.
Right.
You see? So it was not too hard in the south. So you can say they were exploited. Really. But they were exploited like the people in Europe in the Middle Ages, and, you know, everywhere in the world. I mean, that is the historical evolution of civilizations everywhere.
What?
So the impression I had was that I belong to a kind of a middle class, you know.
Mm-hmm.
We had enough to eat. We didn't socialize a bit, a lot. And we had a good life.
How
until World War II.
How often would you said your maternal grandfather was a village chief.
Yes.
I mean, how often would they see a Frenchman in their village?
Very seldom. Because in the village it was of no interest to the French
right.
administrator at all. But they had the constant visits from the district chief. But they were organized, even, you know, those villages, they were organized in a kind of canton, C-A-N-T-O-N.
Mm-hmm.
That would be four or five villages. And my grandfather, maternal grandfather, eventually was promoted to that canton chief, that is to be responsible for four or five villages.
Right.
But then among the canton chiefs, eventually, they would pick up one to become a district chief, and so on, if he were good enough with the French.
Right.
So that is the that was the pattern.
And do you?
And in the cities. And then you see the chance for you to go up the social ladder was to know some French to begin with,
right.
and then to pass an exam, administrative exam, to become a secretary, and secretary of the government. Okay. So then that would be about the 10th grade. Now,
okay.
because that is the maximum of educational level allowed to Vietnamese. You are not, you were not allowed to go over the 10th grade unless you get a scholarship, very exceptional, like my father, to finish, you know, the high school, as we call it, senior high school, and then go over to university level.
How did they choose who would get the scholarships and who would go past the 10th grade?
In the schools. They just pick up the bright guys, you know, to eventually become their French public servants.
So since you started your education at 3 years old, 3.5 years old, you were on a good track.
Yeah, I was already caught in the system.
Right.
You see, when my father was caught in the system,
yeah.
and he was bright enough to go up and up and up. till the end to the top, in the vacational process. So there was a big school in Saigon, Chasselou-Lobat. At that time it was cold, and even Sihanouk went to that school too in Saigon. And my father went to that school, and I also went to that school later
on. Right.
And then in Hanoi you have the An Bai Sero School, you see, that is for to complete your secondary education. And then after that in Hanoi, only in Hanoi, in Saigon they didn't have. But in Hanoi then you have the specialized schools, public works, medical school and law school, etc. So mainly it was for the French nationals. But then eventually, you see, they have absorbed a number of Vietnamese nationals, you know, selected, or the rich ones, and so on. My family, my father was not rich, but he was bright enough to be selected. But many of the rich Vietnamese families were able to send their children to those French schools. And many of those big, rich Vietnamese families then opted the French nationality. In our family, we didn't do that. We would remain Vietnamese nationals all the way until now.
Right.
And but then many of those families became French nationals.
Yeah. How effective do you think the system was?
It was quite effective. It was quite effective because you must, you know, grant credit to those French colonists. They were very good administrators, as they are in France, because the public service in France is you know, very well organized, and in fact they run the country rather than the politicians who come in and out all the time. Very stable system.
So the basic Vietnamese peasant had very, very little contact, if any, with any French colonial administrators.
Yes.
And they didn't hear French spoken very often.
Not at all.
Okay.
Not very much. But of course, through their travel to the provincial cities and so on, they knew there was a French presence.
Okay.
But Adavar must have understood it.
Right.
Until you began to have the so-called traditional political parties. But that was much more in the north than in the south, because in the north they were, we have always considered the northerners were more intellectuals, you know, than in the south. It's colder, life is more difficult. In the south, you know, they don't pay much attention to those things. And there was, of course, a feeling of the French colonial rule, and of course, as anybody anywhere in the world would feel if you were a colony, you see, that you were under the rule of some other country, of a foreign power. And I think the impression was rather, it's a natural thing to accept. It's almost everywhere. You're not the only one, you know, on earth to have that. So that must be, you know, the genuine trend. So you may have heard of the Spanish Empire and the Portuguese Empire and the French Empire and the British Empire. I mean, that seems to be, you know, the thing anywhere in the world.
Right.
And so you accepted your lot. See? Then you begin to feel, is there a possibility to get out of it or not, you see? But I doubt very much that most of the Vietnamese, the 80% of the peasants in the Vietnamese countryside, thought that there was any chance at all, you know, to change that, you see? And if, you know, the few, shall we say, leaders of Vietnam, of the traditional political parties, you know, the Quốc Dân Đảng party, which is called the Patriotic Party, which may also be called the Kuomintang, because they were very related to the Chinese Kuomintang, and then the Dai Viet later on became. Maybe those people of the higher intellectual, you know, capability may have thought that, well, we have to try and, you know, shake off the French colonial rule.
Right.
As anybody else in other parts of the world, they have to, you know, throw away the British Empire in mm-hmm. India or something, you see. Mm-hmm. But the large majority of Vietnamese wouldn't have even, you know, the slightest idea how to do that. And so that was, I think, the state of mind at that time.
So to really throw off the yoke of French colonialism, the intelligentsia, the Vietnamese intelligentsia, yeah. would have to convince the population
yeah.
to go forward with that path.
And that would be, you know, interesting to have a look at it. If you compare to, for example, the previous period of foreign domination, that is about 1,000 years of Chinese domination,
right.
how those Vietnamese reacted to that kind of Chinese rule at that time. Mm-hmm. See, I have the impression that the Chinese also, during those 1,000 years, they did send their troops, you know, to
right.
Clamp down on the
right.
Vietnamese people.
Right.
But they just asked the Vietnamese so-called Imperial Court, mm-hmm. you know, to recognize, you know, the power of of China, you know,
right.
and then pay tributes to them. That's all.
Right.
There was not really Chinese presence, you know, in the countryside of Vietnam. And so but then we had insurrections against Chinese rule.
Yes.
You know,
yes.
many times we were able to throw them away when they were so bad at home. You know, we try to rise up, but when they are stronger, then we try to be quiet and pay the tributes. That's all.
Right.
But with the French, mm-hmm. it was only, I think, with the Second World War,
mm-hmm.
that a number of people, Ho Chi Minh included,
mm-hmm.
who saw the opportunity to regain, you know, independence,
right.
and sovereignty for the Vietnamese people. But that would be, I would say honestly, something new to the Vietnamese people to understand what would mean independence and sovereignty, even less democracy.
Right.
You know, that is not the notion very familiar to them.
Right.
See, that democracy that they knew was at the village level. But not, you know, the constitution, division of powers, you have the deputies, the senators, the president, the prime minister,
right.
and so on. That was completely foreign, you know, and a very Western, you know, concept to the overwhelming majority of the Vietnamese people.
How accepting were the Vietnamese intelligentsia to this idea of Western-type democracy?
If you try and go through the historical, you know, evolution of
mm-hmm.
that. They also learned that from the West,
right.
you know. And then they realized that would be much nicer if we have a greater say, you know, in the government of our own country.
Mm-hmm.
I don't think that they did really hope to overthrow French rule. But then if you look at their requests, the desiderata's, they asked to have more participation
mm-hmm.
in French colonial rule.
Mm-hmm.
That was the best hope that they could imagine. You know? It was only with the disruption of the Second World War,
mm-hmm.
you know, with the fall of the Axis powers, and then with this surrender of Japan, the Japanese troops and so on, that they had the opportunity, very short opportunity, very small opportunity, to claim that they regain sovereignty and independence.
Right.
But to the large majority of the Vietnamese people at that time, I don't think that they were much aware of those things.
Okay.
And if you claim that at that time you represent the Vietnamese people, well, it's not completely untrue,
right.
you know. But if you honestly say that did that mean much to the Vietnamese people in the countryside, I mean, they just wanted to be left alone, go and plow their fields,
mm-hmm.
have enough to feed their kids.
Mm-hmm.
And so if they can do that under French rule, you know, well, they would do it.
Mm-hmm.
If they would do it under Vietnamese rule, or Vietnam rule, Viet Minh rule, they would do it. You know?
Okay.
And so, but then there's a process of education going on, getting, you know, more and more because of the, I think, economic difficulties.
Mm-hmm.
And it is only through that that you would like to have more political freedom,
right.
more political power,
right.
you see? And that is a process that they went through very slowly. Then boom, you had the Vietnam War. I honestly say that the Vietnamese did not understand much why they had the Vietnam War.
The American War or the French?
The American. That is a state of war.
Right.
Why should there be a state of war in Vietnam for 30 years? Which in the end amounted to 5 million dead and 20 million maimed. You see? They didn't know why. They did not, you know, consciously, intentionally say, I go to war. I am prepared to sacrifice 5 million lives to fight for my country and so on. I don't think so. Nobody can honestly say that you were prepared to sacrifice 5 million lives and 20 million maimed and wounded for the defense of independence and sovereignty and democracy and freedom. I don't think so. We can be honest there, you see. It was too big for them to understand. And in fact, we have to eventually come to understand why we had to win the war.
What did your parents tell you about the French administration as you got older?
Well, I didn't talk much with my parents about those things because I left rather quite young in the early teens to France, so I didn't have much of a family life. And then, you know, before I left for France, I can't remember much what happened there.
Okay. Do you remember anything about the Japanese occupation?
Oh, yes. The only thing, I was very young at the time,
right.
10 years old. And, of course, when they came and took over from the French, and then they had the French authorities of the Pétain, the Vichy government, they left images of violence, even cruelty. You know, they were really hard on themselves to begin with, and then on the people around them. They were disciplined, hard guys, and they also had the tradition, custom to incinerate their dead. So I was able to witness, you know, they put it on, you know, the corpses on a pile of wood and then burn those things. You know, and we witnessed those things. We were horrified. We were very young at that time. We were horrified to see the bodies burn like that.
Right.
And so but they left an image of cruelty, of violence. And then they had to surrender and then to give up. And then the French of the Gaulle returned, liberated French returned. So that was the souvenir of those years.
Did you see actual Japanese soldiers walking in your village?
Oh yes, we were at that time, you know, in the deep south. And then eventually when the so-called allies returned, that is with the French troops and the British and so on, then we evacuated. We went back to my parents' villages and stayed there for a while and then moved to Saigon later.
Okay.
So we had the bombing from the French, you know, against the Japanese and so on. But that didn't last very long because they surrendered very fast.
Right.
And then the French returned in 45, 46 they returned. In the north it was Chinese troops,
right,
Jian Luheng, about 150,000 of them.
Right.
But in the south then, according to the agreement with President Truman, the French then had the possibility to reoccupy Indochina.
Did you ever witness any Japanese atrocities or cruelty, as you said?
No, I heard about it.
You just heard stories?
But there were. There were. Yes.
Such as what? What did you hear?
Executions. That is to say, they acted not very different from the Nazi. That is to say, if one of their soldiers were killed, they would take out hostages and then kill them and so on and so forth. That's the methods. But that was the established methods at that time, I think.
So your parents, they were able to deal with this, the the French colonialism and the Japanese occupation and the return of the French.
Yeah, because like most people, you know, they try to be out of those things.
Right.
You know, try to get to the safety zones and, you know, to not to do anything. There was also the case that we had the period of the Viet Minh, mm-hmm. who were able to have power during a few months there. And of course they imprisoned all the landowners, mm-hmm. or whomever had any kind of function under French rule, mm-hmm. and so on. So my maternal grandfather was jailed, was in prison, because he was a village chief. He had a little bit of land, not very big, but he
right.
was a landowner.
Right.
And he was put in prison. But luckily my uncle, that is the younger brother of my mother, who knew the Viet Minh chiefs, the leaders there, and so they were schoolmates long time and dear friends, and that uncle of mine went to see his schoolmate and said, why you put my father in jail, you know, he's a harmless man, you know, and done anything cruel. So he was released after a few days, so that's it.
Okay. Was your father okay? I mean, he had this civil engineer job.
Yeah, and he worked for the Viet Minh.
He just went right along.
Because, you know, they didn't care as a civil engineer, you know. The
right.
guy didn't have, my father didn't have any political views. He's just in his job, you uh-huh. repair roads, repair bridges. Whoever said that told him to repair roads, bridges, he would do it, and that's all.
Okay.
And that was also a very funny thing, because he was given all kinds of the decorations and awards by everybody for repairing roads and bridges for everybody, so including the French.
Right.
So he had the Legion d'honneur, uh-huh. and then the war cross and so on, because when he repair a bridge, you see the forces can go through,
right.
so he was given, you know, military cross and so on, the highest awards of the French government. And then he had the decoration from Bao Dai, from him, from anybody. I think from the Viet Minh too. He had lots of, you know, certificates of satisfaction.
Uh-huh.
You repair well the road of the
right.
thing.
Right.
He never appeared to receive those things.
He did not. He
no,
someone just brought them to
yeah,
the house. Yeah,
sent him by courier. He was not interested.
What did he do with the medals? He just
I don't know. He threw them somewhere. I never saw them. But what mattered to him was that to have funds to repair his road and bridges. That's all.
Right. Right.
He didn't care from whom. As long as I was able to understand in the end,
uh-huh.
for him it didn't matter, you know, who, because he thought that the money would belong to the people anyway. And so whatever, you know, disputes we may have, the roads and bridges are still there for the people to use. So
right.
he did not bother.
Right.
You know, whether it's French money or Viet Minh money or, you know, imperial money or Republican money, same to him.
As long
as somebody paid for the roads and bridges.
Right.
And he didn't make any money out of it. And in fact, he was well known to build the broken bridges, you know, cheaper than anybody else.
Yeah. Did you ever go see him work, do his
oh,
work?
Oh yes, many times.
Yeah.
Many times. Well, I was very young then.
Right.
I enjoy it very much.
Yeah.
Because we were on the same things for a while.
Uh-huh.
Because in the very deep south of the Kamau area.
Living on the sandpans?
On the sandpans.
Okay.
There was no road. He was the one who
right.
started the road.
Right.
And in fact, now you have a town called Nam Cang, which means five compartments. And that was the five compartments, wood compartments that he built for his tools, you know. And there was no town there, there was nothing there.
Mm-hmm.
So it was just an outpost,
right.
you know, for his public works people. And they just used the word Nam Cang, which means the five compartments,
mm-hmm.
to refer to it. And now it has become the name of the town there, Nam Cang. That is the farthest south that you can go. there was jungle there, marshes. And of course we didn't have much to eat at that time, so we ate the a kind of chimpanzee, you know, kind of monkey with very long arms, you know. Half the face is black, the other half is white. They just, you know, swang on the trees and then and so the flesh is not too bad, it's very tender. It's almost chicken. Yeah, I remember. Okay. But the horrible thing was that they you know, the workers, and so on, they kill those poor beasts by dozens in order to feed everybody,
right,
you know, with meat. And what was horrible, I remember, one of the horrible things I remember was that the skulls, tiny skulls like this, like oranges, of those little monkeys. And there were piles and piles of those skulls. Oh my God.
You remember seeing these piles of monkey skulls.
Yeah, but that didn't prevent me to eat the meat.
Right,
that was good.
Did you see them on these hunting expeditions? Would they go out as a group, or would your father go?
Oh, no, we just traveled, you know. And then when we saw one, we just shoot. They just shoot them with those kind of carbines. Mm-hmm. And there was also a kind of a small alligator, small, about 3-4 feet long. And the meat is almost kind of veal beef taste, which is not bad. Mm-hmm. We ate that too.
Okay. Did you ever find and catch snakes and eat snakes?
Oh, the snakes, the snail, the frogs, that's the usual thing.
Yeah.
That's the usual thing. Okay, that's for the souvenir.
Yeah, it's
Chinese souvenir.
Yes.
So coming back to the kind of living conditions that most of the people have, you know, those in the cities, those who managed to have some education, those who were thrown into the factories, that is the beginning of the intelligentsia and so on. But the large majority, 80-90%, were in the rural areas,
right,
and were not very much aware of what was going on.
Okay. How did your parents push you to go to school for education?
Yes, very much.
They emphasized this.
Yes. And that was one of the main priorities, because most of those families, they just wanted to have their children to be educated somehow.
Right.
So you had also good schools. There were good schools. I mean, the French, they allowed good schools. What I say, they under the French system, you were only allowed to go to the 10th grade maximum.
Right.
They called it a diploma. So when you have a diploma, you can get a job in the offices. But after the diploma, you can sit for an exam to join the public service. And so you become the secretary,
right,
of the administration.
Right.
That is the beginning of the social ladder. You go up and up and up and up.
Okay.
So if your family is wealthy enough, was wealthy enough, and then had opted for the French nationality, then you can go all the way up and go to France for further education and so on.
Was there any expectation from your father that you would follow in his footsteps and be a bridge builder?
I don't think so. That is, his concern was to give us, you know, the best education possible, and he was able financially, you know, to send us to Europe.
Right.
Because I think he had the impression that the education that you may have in France would be much better than the one you can ever dream of in Vietnam. So that was the reason when we had the opportunity. He had the opportunity, he would send us there.
I've heard from a number of people that I've spoken with that they have this image of Vietnam under the French, that the Vietnamese were kind of captive in the country, that they weren't free to travel anywhere, really, to Laos, Cambodia, Thailand, or outside of Southeast Asia. So
that's not true.
Vietnamese could if
that's
they had the funds,
because
they could go.
Under French rule, you know, the three Indochinese so-called countries were one.
Right.
So you were free to move anywhere, but the main thing is that wherever you went, would you be able to make a living out of it? You see, so
right.
The main thing is to find a place where you have a work to do and then to survive.
Mm-hmm.
So And if you look into the history of the Indochina under French rule, you would see that many of the public servants, government servants in Laos and Cambodia were Vietnamese.
Right.
You see? And so, except for the rich people in Laos and in Cambodia, you see, the other people were not much, you know, in the position to fill those positions mm-hmm. in the administration. And so that is why you have a large community of Vietnamese in Cambodia. Who then eventually were absorbed into the Cambodian society mm-hmm. and became those, you know, half-breeds of Vietnamese Cambodian.
Right.
And there. And they were not prevented to move, but they were not able to move. It's not a matter of legislation. It's
right.
a matter of economic opportunities.
Right. In 1948, at age 13, mm-hmm. you went to
Paris.
To Paris.
Yes.
Before you went to Paris, you went to school in Saigon.
In Saigon.
Tell me about your experience.
That is a very well-known school, you know. And I think Cecil Loba was the name of the admiral, the French admiral or something, who came to Indochina.
Mm-hmm.
And that was a school for the French boys. It's a boys' school.
Mm-hmm.
There was another for the girls called the Marie Curie, you know, the mm-hmm. scientist,
right.
French woman scientist. And that was for the girls' school. But then, parallel to that, there were also two other schools, one for girls and one for boys, but then reserved completely for the Vietnamese.
Okay.
But the Chasseloup Loba schools was for the French. And then for the few, you know, Vietnamese who were able to get in. And then it was also a very good school for people from Laos and Cambodia. And that's why Prince Sihanouk mm-hmm. went there too.
Okay.
Yes.
Did you go to school with French boys?
Oh, yes. The okay. majority were French boys.
Okay. So you weren't segregated. The Vietnamese boys weren't segregated away from the French boys. You were all in the same classroom.
That school, then you have integration, because
okay.
the Vietnamese who were accepted there were supposed to be already,
right.
you know, under French uh-huh. influence and rule. But the other Vietnamese boys couldn't get in and had to go to another school
okay.
called the Petruski School. And there they were allowed only to go up to the 10th grade.
Okay.
That's it.
Okay. What was your impression of the French boys? This is the first time, I assume, that you were around them.
There was a very clear impression that they were superior to begin with, economically, socially, and everything.
Right.
See? And of course, the Vietnamese boys who were there were considered as the lucky ones, you know, and were more or less accepted,
okay.
you know, by the French community already to be there. You see? So we were there as, you know, exceptions, privilege. You know, boys, to be among the mm-hmm. friendly boys.
Mm-hmm.
And I think we were considered more or less French too. I didn't have that impression, but the large majority of the people, you know, outside would say, oh, those Vietnamese boys attending those French schools, you know, they are completely, you know, French. Termed French, probably. Which may not be true, but
right.
that is the general impression. That would be understandable, of course.
Right. You were made to speak French, or did you?
We spoke French only. It's a
French
school, completely.
And did you receive a good education?
Yeah, it's good. Very good education.
What kind of subjects were you taught?
Well, it's like in all French schools in France right now. The
same thing.
Exactly. As you know, the French curriculum is very broad.
Mm-hmm.
They cover everything. That's why the French, they are very good talkers.
Okay, so how many years were you there in Saigon at this elementary school?
Well, I was up there until I left for France.
Mm-hmm.
So that is after the war. Mm-hmm. It's just for two or 3 years, I think.
Okay.
2 or 3 or 4 years.
Were you expecting, when you went to this school, did you think that, okay, yes, when I finish this, then I'm probably going to go to Paris to continue my studies.
I didn't have any idea what was happening to me. And in fact, I was still very young there, you know, only 10 or 12 years old. And there was an incident too at that time. And that was, there was, you know, a movement from Ho Chi Minh at that time already, the late 40s.
Right.
And there were agitations in the Vietnamese schools, rather. But there was also that French school. They were circulating photographs of Ho Chi Minh side by side with Lenin, Karl Marx. There was photographs with Mao Zedong, Stalin, I think, something, if I remember correctly.
The Vietnamese boys were circulating these?
Yeah, circulating that in that French school. And I was one of those boys who distributed those photographs too. I didn't know what they were, you know. But then we were caught.
Right.
We were caught, of course. And my father was called, and I was, in principle, expelled. So my father took me home, spanked me a lot. Why do you do things like that? You know,
right.
You do things like that. I don't know. The guys gave me those things to do, but I just disappeared. That's all.
Right.
And so he managed somehow, you know, to explain. And then I was returned to the school, you know, probably because it was clear I didn't know what I was doing. I had no connection with any, you know, organizations or groups or anything. So
right.
It was accepted that I was returned to school. That was an incident.
Hmm.
That showed you that there was some agitation already.
So apparently some of the Vietnamese boys were aware of Ho Chi Minh's movement.
Yes.
And what was going on in the north.
Oh, yes. Probably much more of the southerners rather than be influenced from the north.
Mm-hmm.
But of course, they knew about Ho Chi Minh and so on. But I think most of the southerners down there were motivated, you know, the intelligentsia motivated with it much more in the southern frame of mind.
Mm-hmm.
I didn't have the impression that they were very well organized or related with the groups in North Vietnam. I didn't have that impression still now. They wanted to be, you know, to check off the French rule, colonial rule, and so on. That was everywhere.
Right.
That was the general feeling. We didn't like the French on our back, although we enjoy the kind of life that they offered. But I think that there was some, relatively, we may say that in the cities and the countryside, there was a relative impression of peace. There was not, there was no war.
Right.
There may be some, action from the Viet Minh here and then, but was negligible that time. It was negligible.
If there's this feeling of peace, then Ho Chi Minh is basically declaring war on the French in the north and wants to oust them. Did that run against what people in the south wanted? I mean, they wanted the French off your backs.
Of course. I mean, there's a general impression that the French have returned.
Okay.
So maybe you cannot do anything against it. It's too big for you. On the other hand, there was a relative feeling that they were left in peace. They could continue to plow their little piece of land, lot of land, and then people were able to have their trades going on. I mean,
right.
Just after the Second World War, it was hard for everybody. And so, they to tell them that life is hard because of the French colonial rule, you know, that would not really, catch on. But life was hard for everybody.
Right.
You know, after the Second World War, and they were aware of it. But then there was in the intelligentsia, in some quarters, the desire to shake off colonial rule. That was clear. You see, but I wouldn't say that was conscience of the majority of the people in the countryside, as long as they were not disrupted by either side, the French or the Vietnamese, and then they would be happy.
Okay. I'm just curious, something just occurred to me. Going back to the Japanese and their defeat in World War II, were the Vietnamese, the majority of the Vietnamese population, aware of the atomic bombing, of how the war actually ended?
I think they heard about it, but they could not imagine the magnitude of such an action. You see, probably they were horrified, you know. But I doubt very much that most of the people who were not very educated were very aware what kind of weapon was that. They heard that hundreds of thousands of people died, but then they heard that also that during the Second World War, millions of people died too. I mean, but that, as I said, the Second World War, except for the Japanese presence, didn't touch the Vietnamese much compared to other countries. For example, even Singapore, Thailand, or Burma, they had really fighting there with the Japanese. But in Vietnam, you didn't fight the Japanese very much. They just took over from the French, and then they surrendered again, and they left. See, and they were there just a few months.
For those Vietnamese who were aware that the United States had dropped two atomic bombs on Japan, these huge, massive weapons, do you think that shaped at all their idea of the United States later, when America had a presence in the 1950s in Vietnam, that okay, these are the guys who used an atomic bomb. They have this massive firepower. Did that shape the Vietnamese thought at all about toward the Americans?
I'm sure that the educated ones, Vietnamese, were able to understand what was going on. But the overwhelming majority of the Vietnamese did not have any idea about the United States. They had an idea about Mother France. See? And then somehow remotely there was a country called the United States that would call the Americans. They were not probably even aware of the proper name United States of America. They were Americans somewhere out there, supposed to be rich, and rich mean powerful, but they wouldn't understand what powerful would mean, you see. But it seemed that with the help of the Americans, Europeans were able to fight Hitler. They were able to understand Hitler was a bad man. And then they were really, I'm sure, happily, you know, impressed that the Allies, so that was the term that they were familiar with, the Allies, see, not the Americans, the Allies. And when the French returned, they returned also in the name of the Allies, because they were the British, the Indian, I don't know. Right. So the French were clever there to return as the Allies, you see. And then the people in the countryside did not hear that the French, you know, came back, the French bombers and so on and so forth.
Right.
There was some bombing.
Right.
And then it was only later on, see, after that period of the Allies, right after the Second World War, that the same French guys came back. That was the impression I think most people had.
Okay.
But then it would then at that time, you know, come to another context, completely different context. That is to say, the French came back, the same guys, but they came back now to a different thing, to a different situation. It was not like in the old times.
Would you like to take a break?
Oh, sure.
Break.
Okay. Any good?
This is Dr. Richard Varun resuming the interview with Ambassador Fong. And it is now Thursday, September 26th, 2002, and we are at the Texas Tech University Southwest Collections Special Collections Library building. And this morning, Ambassador Fong, we left off when we were discussing your time in Saigon, in elementary school there, and your transition is upcoming to Paris. This was in 1948. I believe you were 13 years old at the time. And could you discuss a little bit about how did you make the decision, or did your family make the decision for you to go overseas to Europe to study, continue your studies?
Well, I must say I'm very happy to continue with the interview, and it's rather hard to remember things more than half a century ago, but I try my best. Well, as I said yesterday, we were there to see after the Second World War, and then the French were back at that time, and things seemed to resume as they were before the Second World War. That is to say, we didn't have much yet of any resistance movement or any kind of warlike acts against the French. They were a bit much more, I'm sure, in the north, but in the southern part of Vietnam, you can travel by day and night easily. There were occasionally acts of, shall we say, sabotage, or I would say reprisals against the administrative machinery of the French in the countryside, the villages, the districts, and so on. So at that time, I would say, there was a general feeling that there was some kind of resistance against the return of the French. But relatively speaking, you see, the resistance movements were nothing to match against the presence of the French forces that were, which were called expeditionary forces.
Right.
And they were back there. But there was a beginning of a feeling of resistance and actions of resistance against the return of the French. Okay. So, for unknown reasons, I don't know, my father decided to send my brother and me to France. Maybe because we had also a cousin, much older at that time, the son of the elder sister of my mother, and by the name of Cat, C-A-C. And his father was one of the, who say, the provincial deputies, you know, of our native province of Ben Tre. He was in the rice business, he was quite wealthy, and if you remember, he was the one who married my mother's sister, who was supposed to be my father's wife. So that was the case, and probably I think that my father made the decision to send my brother and me with that cousin when his father decided to send him to France. So I think my brother, who is about 4 years older than I was at that time, and as most of those youngsters who were very fortunate to go to France at that time, we took a very old boat, I think that was called the Champollion. That's the name of the French the archaeologist who worked on the pyramids in Egypt, Champollion. I think he was the first one to decipher the hieroglyphs writings of our own Egypt. And so arrangements were also made for us to join the Lycée Michelet, which is just the outskirts of Paris at the Porte de Versailles. And it was a boarding school. We were able to stay there. And the shall we say, deputy head of that school was designated as a kind of legal tutor for us. So he took care of us. See, so that was the first contact I had with the French family. The man was a very good man, with a real typical French wife, you know, housewife type, and he had only one daughter, and by the name of Yvonne, I think. And he was also in the Second World War, veteran, fought very hard, was wounded and so on. Mm-hmm. Eventually he became the head of one of the largest schools, in high school in Paris, that's Lycée Montaigne, many years later. And he was also the president of the Association of Headmasters or something. So he did very well.
Okay.
And I was able to see him again when I returned for the Paris Peace Talks. Mm-hmm. And in fact, he came to my house for dinner, and then passed away the next day. So that was really exceptional that I was able to meet him again, just in extremis. So we were at the Lycée Michelet there, and you can imagine the kind of life we had after the Second World War in France. There was almost nothing, not much food, not much clothing, and we had to go to the flea markets to find something to wear and things like that. So that was the kind of life we had.
Do you remember when you initially left Vietnam? How did you feel? Were you excited? Were you sad?
Well, excited, yes, and sad at the same time, because we had to leave the parents there, mm-hmm. you see, but we were so young, and I'm sure that the excitement, you know, took over the whole thing, the adventure and so on and so forth.
So. Right. So tell me about your schooling in Paris when you got there.
Well, I went there to finish my secondary education, so I integrated myself quite well. Because I moved from the French schooling system in Saigon, and then moved continuously to the French system in Paris, so there was no problem at all.
Okay.
And in fact, I was rather a bright student, because I think I jumped one or two classes when I was even in Saigon, you know, after the war, and they found out that I could be of the upper form, you know, and I did quite well. And in Paris, I did quite well too, because I was really excited to be able to be in Paris and study with, and being a boarder. Mm-hmm. You know, I didn't have anywhere to go. Mm-hmm. With kids. Most of the other boarders went home.
Right.
But we stayed there, and we had that tutor who's living there too, mm-hmm. in the school. And so it was a very good life that we had, and it was a good school. Beautiful school,
you know,
large grounds, and have a small wood at the back, and they have all these sports grounds and a swimming pool. Mm-hmm. But I must tell you a very funny story here too, because when I was with the French school, this is Lycée Lubin in Saigon, mm-hmm. I was very good in swimming.
Okay.
You know, among the youngsters, you know, I stood out as a very good swimmer, and the teacher of swimming in Saigon. His name was Tarus, T-A-R-U-S, I think, Tarus, or T-A-R-R-I-S, something like that.
Okay.
And when he said, "Fong, you have, skills for swimming, you should try, you know, and develop those things." And when I arrived at the Lycée Michelet in Paris, I found him there again. You know,
your Saigon teacher.
Yes, the Saigon teacher, and he was there also teaching swimming.
Oh.
And so I continued with my swimming, you know. So, there was another chap too who was in Saigon, but he's French, by the name of Yves Le Roy, big guy. Mm-hmm. And he was with me, you know, the hopeful, mm-hmm. you know, future swimmers. Mm-hmm. And we found ourselves there in the same school with the same swimming teacher. Mm-hmm. And so we continue our training. And Yves Le Roy eventually became a professional swimmer, you know, represented France at the European contest and championship and so on. He did very well. And I was able to see him again in the late 60s when I returned for the Paris Peace Talks. Mm-hmm. And there you are. I missed my vocation to be a professional swimmer.
So your classmates, you were These were Vietnamese students and French students.
Oh yes, there were many Vietnamese students at that list initially. Okay. And we have maintained relations even until now.
Okay.
Many of them passed away. But,
right. And how were they accepting of you? I mean, again, were they...
No problem.
No problems?
Yes, okay. I think there was no... you know, the French, traditionally, they integrate people rather easily. It's much easier in the past than now, because now probably you have other problems.
Yeah. Mm. What were your favorite subjects? What did you study?
Well, I like history. Read a lot. That was the time when I was first very impressed with the theories of Anne Frank. Mm-hmm. That impressed me very much.
Mm-hmm.
And then I was really also interested in the writings of Jean-Jacques Rousseau. I don't know why. And I was also very touched and impressed by the poems of Musset, Musset. And Musset, as you know, has always been considered as the poet of love.
Okay.
But especially, you know, sufferings from love.
Broken hearts.
Yeah. And then I think he was the boyfriend of Georges Lassalle,
uh-huh.
You know, the French writer, mm-hmm. who tried to be a man. That's why she took the man's name, Georges.
Mm-hmm.
Georges Lassalle. Great French writer, who also after Musset had all the boyfriends, of course, musicians and other artists.
What besides history and literature, did you enjoy economics or politics? Or
not much.
No,
not much. I mean, I was under the influence of the French, you know, rather a bit romantic than practical.
Okay. What did you think of the French culture? This is your first time out of Vietnam.
Well, the first thing which impressed me was the Vietnamese presence and the Vietnamese communities there, because as you know, the Vietnamese went to France very early, at the First World War. So many of them were sent there to fight among the French troops, you know, and many of those Vietnamese remain in Paris and in France, and many of them also became workers of the Renault car manufacturer, you know, in Billancourt.
Mm-hmm.
And so there, you see, even in the early 90s, at the time of the First World War,
mm-hmm.
you had the beginning of that Vietnamese presence in Paris. So they have been there for generations.
Right.
And so we were able to mix with that Vietnamese community easily, because many of them were my parents' acquaintances and so on. So we were able to visit them. And then I must tell you that a couple of years later, my mother was missing me very much.
Mm-hmm.
I had been the benchman, the youngest.
Mm-hmm.
And so they had also the opportunity to go to France in,
okay.
In the summer of 1950.
Okay.
My father, who was not French nationality,
mm-hmm.
has always remained, but through his work, he was considered as equivalent to a French national under the public service, you know, of the French there. And he was permitted to have his annual vacation in France, own paid by the French authority.
Wow.
And so, but he had also another good reason, because my mother had an ulcer of the stomach.
Mm-hmm.
And so they were prepared to pay for her to go with him to France for the treatment of that.
Mm-hmm.
Very funny thing, because they contacted a very famous a French professor, you know, a specialist,
mm-hmm.
In that kind of ulcers and so on and so forth. And he treated my mother, but with no result whatsoever. Then she said that she would try her traditional medicine you know, that she has been used to, she has been used to in Vietnam. Mm-hmm. And then they sent her, you know, the medicine from Vietnam when she was in Paris, and then she continued to take those traditional medicine things. And then the French specialists were very amazed, you know, that she improved. Then she put on weight and everything.
Okay.
And so we were able to have our parents there. They were there in the summer of the 1950.
Okay. How long did they stay?
They stay probably 6 months or something.
Wow. So they were able to visit nicely with you?
Yes, yes. And it was also at that time that we went on a summer vacation in the south of France, and my father and my mother took me to visit Emperor Bao Dai, who had a castle, you know, just outside Caen, mm-hmm. in the Le Canet, mm-hmm. that is the Chateau de Torrens. Mm-hmm. And because my father had opportunities to meet the emperor before in Saigon, and that was the only visit that I had with Emperor Bao Dai.
What do you remember about that visit?
Oh, not much. You know, I was so young, mm-hmm. but I was really impressed by the house, mm-hmm. an enormous thing. And when he tried to, keep up with King Farouk, mm-hmm. of Egypt, who was there in the south of France, gambling and womanizing and so on. So Bao Dai was also a kind of playboy as well. Mm-hmm. Tried to put up with the Jones, but then went bankrupt and had to sell his castle. Because his next neighbor was the Aga Khan. So he was rich.
Okay. So you were, what, 15 at
this
point?
Yes, around that, 14, 15 or something.
Okay. And you were able to, did you stay there in the castle when you went to the south?
Oh, no, just to visit. Just visit. We went there for the vacation, the summer vacation, just a few weeks there.
Okay.
I think 2 weeks or something.
Okay.
And then I continued with the Lycée Michelet, and mm-hmm. my parents went home.
Did you feel like you got a good education there at this school in Paris?
I think so, because I think the French educational facilities and system, and especially Lycée Michelet, very well known, is one of the larger schools in Paris. Many famous people went through there too. And it was a good boarding school for us.
Mm-hmm.
And so we were quite happy. But you know, at that time, in the late 40s in Paris, you had the existentialists, Jean-Paul Sartre, Simone de Beauvoir, and then you had that kind of a crowd, mm-hmm. you know, very progressive thinking,
mm-hmm.
Materialistic, and mm-hmm. even very much on the left side, mm-hmm. at the Saint-Germain-des-Prés, when you had all those, cellars where you had jazz, and then mm-hmm. the influence of the American jazz coming there with Sidney Bechet and so on, New Orleans time, mm-hmm. and the bebop dance. And so, but that was the whole atmosphere of that period.
So you remember this
Oh,
music?
I remember that very well. Yeah. Because I used to dance the bebop rather well too. I was 14 or 15, I think.
Uh-huh. Tell me about what would you do after school for your entertainment? You would go to these clubs or...?
Well, occasionally, on Sundays.
Uh-huh.
Because we were in a boarding school, we were not allowed to get out of the school at all.
During the week, except,
leave. Yes.
Okay.
Yeah.
And so on the weekends you would go?
Yes, then we would be even allowed to go out in groups.
Okay.
And we have to ask permission. And for those of us who did not have any family, so we were allowed on Sunday to get out and in the evening to return and so on.
Okay. Any opportunity to date girls?
I didn't have any idea about dating girls
at
that time. We went out, there were girls. But our school was a boys' school.
Right.
Completely boys' school.
Okay.
But with the French friends, often they took their sisters with them and mm-hmm. friends with them. So we were able to mix with all kinds of people. But that was it.
What do you think was the hardest thing for you while you were there in Paris?
The hardest thing, of course, I was homesick. you're at that age. And then also the material, you know, situation. The food, we had plenty of food, but it was not really palatable. Lots of mashed potatoes and things like that.
Right.
And not much meat, you see. And we had rabbits rather. Never had beef or anything more expensive. It's a big school, so it must be difficult for them to buy those good things. And we had lots of camembert, the French cheese, that's very cheap. And lots of bread and things like that.
What was the, do you have an outstanding memory of these days? What was the best thing that you can remember about your time there?
Nothing special. That was a whole general thing, which was good in almost all aspects. And I was also impressed, for example, by the French films, the French film industry beginning to develop. And there were the summer festivals, film festivals in Paris. And so I remember I went there and met the film stars and so on. And there was one by the name of Martine Caro. And she was probably the leading lady star at that time. And she took a liking of me because she was also the godmother of the Vietnam House at the Paris University compound. And I was with the elder Vietnamese chaps there, and one evening she was there, she patronized the pavilion of Vietnam and Cambodia and Laos. They called it the Maison de l'Indochine, the Indochina House. And then she took a liking. I was the youngest, you know. And then she became kind of a godmother to me too. So that was Martine Caro. She had a tragic end because I think she drowned somewhere in one of the French islands in summer vacation. So that was the few things I managed to remember.
This is your first exposure to Western culture.
Oh, yes, my first. I mean, besides the French boys in Saigon.
Right. Yes. What did you think? You said you mentioned some of the American culture that you experienced, the music, the jazz music.
Yes, and as all the French in Paris at that time, you know, they were also very impressed by anything American, you know.
Okay.
Anything American. After the Second World War, you know, anything American is good, was good.
How large was that Vietnamese community in Paris? Was
very large. I mean, hundreds of thousands.
Really?
Hundreds of thousands. And many of them were in the, what you call the Quartier Latin. Actually was the, and still is, the students area. That is the fifth district, the fifth and the sixth district. So we have lots and lots of Vietnamese restaurants there, and then they live there. They seem to cluster a little bit around there.
Right.
And now they have moved to the 13th district, which is kind of a Chinatown of Paris now.
Okay.
There are lots of Vietnamese living there, but there are lots of Chinese too.
Did you go to the Eiffel Tower?
Not at all. That's a good Parisian. At that time, I didn't go to the Eiffel Tower. It was only later on when I returned for the Paris Peace Talks that I had the first opportunity to climb on the Eiffel Tower. And you know the joke that a good, real and true Parisian, you know, never goes on the Eiffel Tower. He may pass by, you know, every day, but he never have the time to go up there. That's probably the same with New Yorkers on the Empire State Building, I suppose.
It's just part of the landscape.
Yeah.
Another building. Okay. Well, from Paris, you transitioned to London. Now, how did you, how did that decision come about? How did
we had no idea at all, again, you know, and my father just decided that when we finish our French secondary education, and probably, I guess only, that he might have thought and that the conditions for the studies would be much better in England Then in France, because at that time, as I mentioned to you, mm-hmm. you know, lots of jazz and dancing and that's all right. in Paris. And, you know, always that impression he had, wrongly or rightly, that you have gay Paris, you know, Paris.
Right.
And so he sent us to London, both my brother and me.
Okay.
In 1952.
Mm-hmm.
But there was also a friend who was there by the name of Tan Quy Thanh, who's now in California, much older than my brother and me. But he was a graduate of the LSE, the London School of Economics, and he was with the Chartered Bank in London for training.
Okay.
And his family, his elder brother, was a kind of an assistant to my father in Vietnam for the road building and so mm-hmm. on. In fact, my father taught him all the trade mm-hmm. to the elder brother. And so he, there was that family friend, Tan Quy Thanh, who eventually was also a kind of finance minister of Saigon government mm-hmm. in the 1964-65 with General Khanh, I think, when Khanh was prime minister. He's now in California. Mm-hmm. So he was willing to take care of us in London when we first arrived there in the summer of 1952. And it was made, the arrangements was made with him to find a place for us to stay in London. And it was also decided between my father and Mr. Thanh there that we would try to improve our English right. language at the French Institute in London,
okay.
Which is which was a kind of bilingual, you know, institute in the South Kensington area in London. So we were put in a kind of a family, and very funny, the family name there was Mr. Brown.
The Brown
was the first time we had dealing with a Mr. Brown, and we stay in his family. We had a room in his house, mm-hmm. and he provided the meals and mm-hmm. so on. So we continue. And
your brother is with you at this point?
Yes,
okay.
We were together. We went there at the same time together. And that was the idea. My father, you know, put us together so that the elder brother would take care of the younger brother and things like that. And we were at the French Institute to improve our English too. Which was very poor. I mean, we only had that English knowledge of English in Paris mm-hmm. through the French educational system mm-hmm. as the first foreign language,
okay.
you know, which they call the anglais vivant, you know, live English.
Live English.
And so we started there, but very soon the French Institute also helped us to get some kind of you know, professional skills and so on and so forth, you know, while improving our English there. And so both my brother and I, we were sent to a kind of a school which is, was named the London Foreign Trade School or something.
Mm-hmm.
Now these are the kind of schools that came out of the professional guilds of Britain,
mm-hmm.
you know, centuries ago when they had those guilds,
right,
you know,
right.
By profession, the carpenters, the masons,
right.
and so on. And as you know, they have that kind of guild for own the fields, like the bankers, the architects, and so
mm-hmm.
on. So that in the British system of education, they went parallel with the university,
mm-hmm.
but much more on the practical side, and so they have equivalents. You know, people from the university can join them to go to, for example, the Institute of Bankers.
Mm-hmm.
Then you work with the banks while you are attending the university, and on this side too, they can go to university, but they belong to those professional organizations.
Okay.
And those professional organizations, the trade guilds, they
mm-hmm.
call it, they make you associates, fellows
mm-hmm.
of those guilds,
mm-hmm.
Which would be the equivalent, some would say, of the bachelor's degree or the master's degree or the PhD, you know, as you are, as you go up, and you belong to those professional things. And so again, for you know, out of the blue, I joined the commerce course.
Commerce
and shipping. In fact,
okay,
it was a. And so it was already, because it was foreign trade, so we have foreign transactions and so on and so forth. I stayed there for 4 years while improving my English at the French Institute. And they had also lots of those people at the French Institute too, you know, learning French, probably for their commercial purposes and so on. So that was how it went.
And you were there for 4 years?
Oh, we were there at the French Institute at the London School of Foreign Trade for 4 years.
And then
my brother went home because he my father said that he has obtained a job for my brother at the Vietnam Airlines, the national carrier there. And so my brother left me in 1956 in the summer.
He completed his schooling, or not?
Yes, he has also, as the same. He did also the commerce course, and so he went home. So I was really lost, you know. But during those years in London, many times I had the opportunity to visit Oxford with friends,
right,
English friends and so on. And I was really, you know, bewildered by the place. You know the place, beautiful.
I've been there before, it is.
And I didn't know what to do with myself at that time, really. And I was, 20 years old there, in 56, that summer. And I just went to Oxford and tried to find out how I can get in, you know. And the university, very hard to get in, because Oxford and Cambridge, they are the two residential universities. So your admission is limited to the beds they have there, you see. It's not that you can stay home and go there.
Right.
You have to complete your terms and so on, your presence there, and that is much more important than even attending lectures. And it is a whole life that you have to live through, you know, which they call your Oxford career. You participate in all kinds of things. And the main things for you to see your tutors and write your weekly essays and present those essays to them. They didn't pay much attention to, you know, to lectures you attend or what you have your hours of credit. You know, that's not the main worry.
Right.
That is the terms of residence that you have there. And so the people down there advised me that the quickest thing for me to get in, and the easiest thing for me to get in, probably to take that course in economics and political science.
Okay.
As you know, with the Oxford system, when you go in, you have to get your BA. And your BA, then the nearest to us, to me at that time in economics and commerce, would be the PPP or the PPE, philosophy, politics, economics, or philosophy, politics, and psychology, which would then give you a BA.
Okay.
And the people there then advised me there's no need for you to take the BA, just enroll in one of the specialized diplomas, like diploma of agriculture, diploma of statistics, that would serve the purpose with the home office to grant you the visa to remain in England, because we were on the student visa, and we must have a school to accept us. So that's why, you know, blindly I just enrolled for the diploma in economics and political science. But with the tutors there, it was understood that they will organize a kind of a program for me, rather in international relations, international economics, and with emphasis on the political and philosophy aspects of things. So it was rather, you know, extracurricular program. The thing is for you to organize with the dons to accept you to be your tutors in a certain subject. So each term you have two or three subjects, you know, political history, political theory, and all these things. And so I had, in fact, a four-year research study course there. But in order to satisfy the legal requirements of the immigration, I had to have that diploma in economics and political science, which I passed in 58, and then I just continued the course in international relations and international economics.
Okay.
Yeah.
How did you? Was there a cost involved? How did you pay?
Oh yes, there was cost involved, but my father paid.
Okay.
By that time he was also the chairman of the Tele Vietnam, which was the wireless radio communications between Vietnam. It's a kind of a French company,
mm-hmm.
a private company, and which is called Tele Vietnam. And they paid him to be the chairman. And that kind of remuneration was just good, you know, to pay for my studies at Oxford. Just right. Which was about, I think, £20 a month or something at that time. So that would be, I don't know, $50 in 1956 a month.
That's incredible.
So that would be $600 a year.
To attend Oxford University.
Yeah.
That's a pretty good bargain.
Yeah.
Can we go back to London for a moment? What was the flavor of London in the early 1950s? You were there from 1950
yes,
to 56.
I was very much, you know, within the French community there.
Uh-huh.
You know, in South Kensington, you have
uh-huh.
French coffee shops and all the French community around there. And I had a great time. Because I was able to be in the French atmosphere, which was not too difficult for me to integrate in.
Mm-hmm.
And at the same time, I was able then to learn more about the British and the
mm-hmm.
English people. And the English voice I like very much. They are peculiar, as you know, the British.
Peculiar.
There's a big difference with the French.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, in France, we try very much to try to have best food, usually.
Right.
And the drinks and wines, you see.
Uh-huh.
The French didn't pay much attention to their living accommodations. So that's why you have a big shortage of housing in France, because they prefer to eat than, you know. And even then, if you live in France at that time, you would find out that, you know, many of the houses there, they don't have even enough, you know, facilities for taking a shower, a bath, you know, those things. On the contrary, the British, they were very keen, you know, on their living accommodation. So
mm-hmm.
there was no problem to find a place, a nice place, a roomy place.
Mm-hmm.
Lots of bathrooms and so on and so forth. But the food was lousy, of course, with the British. And when we arrived there, there was still rationing. You know, one
right.
week a week, and you can't even buy a chewing gum or candies without your sweet coupons and things like that.
Even this is 10 years after World War II.
Oh, yeah. Yes. And it's probably early in 55.
Okay.
We arrived there in 52. So, and the next year was the coronation of Elizabeth II.
Right.
So I was able to witness that in the streets, of course. But rationing was still on until 55. And amazing, they didn't have any black market thing because the British were not interested to buy anything to eat on the black market. Happy with one egg a week, and that's it. And their potatoes.
Right, right. What was your impression of the British people? Were they friendly? Were they?
Well, at first I found them less friendly than the French.
This is just a reminder.
Sorry, continue. They were friendly? If they?
Well, at first I thought that they were much less friendly than the French.
Mm-hmm.
You know, they're much reserved,
mm-hmm.
phlegmatic, the British phlegmatic attitude. You see,
uh-huh.
But once you know them. They open up completely in private, you know,
right.
In the homes, but in the street would be much different from the French. I mean, you don't talk easily to a British in the street.
Right.
You know, he would be on his defensive. You know.
Mm-hmm.
And usually when you want to start and not to, worry him too much, you say, a nice day today, and things like that, before you ask for directions
mm-hmm.
to the post office.
How did you like London itself? Was it?
It's different.
Comparable.
Completely. completely different.
Mm-hmm.
See, people behave in a different way,
mm-hmm.
much more disciplined.
Mm-hmm.
When you go to the bus stop, you know, and they queue right away. It's not like in France, you know, everybody by himself rush to the bus or to the subway.
Mm-hmm.
So they're much more disciplined. So it's a different way of life.
Mm-hmm.
They prefer their clubs, you know, it's much more private way of things. And in the street they behave, you know, it's not like the friends yelling, kissing everywhere.
You mentioned the food was not so good there. What else bothered you about London? What was, did you find anything difficult there living in London?
The fog.
The fog?
And the drizzle. You know, a fine rain coming down all the time, you know.
Okay.
And you may not have the sun for weeks.
Wow.
It's grey and mm-hmm. And of course the houses are grey too.
What about your drink? The nightlife?
We didn't go out much.
Mm-hmm.
But we went to the students' clubs and things like that. So had also music and
okay.
Dancing and things like that. As old young people.
Mm-hmm.
But we had a very, respectable life.
So it was more...
Probably here from our customs and traditions.
Okay.
What I must say is this, you know, when we arrived in England in the early 50s there, I was told, and we were able to meet some, there were probably about 20 Vietnamese in England at that time.
Big difference from Paris.
Yes, big difference, very big difference. And we were able to meet occasionally. They were all students.
Okay.
From both North and South Vietnam,
mm-hmm.
from the families.
Mm-hmm.
And we stayed there, I stayed there almost 10 years, 8 years in England.
Mm-hmm.
And so we had the opportunity to know one another among
mm-hmm.
the Vietnamese
mm-hmm.
in London. And it was also amazing that in the end, you know, those 20 Vietnamese who were in England returned home. And exactly 10 of them went to Hanoi and 10 of them went to Saigon.
Really?
And when I was in prison in Hanoi, I was able to relocate a few of them who was in Hanoi. One of them was working for Hanoi Radio.
Really?
Because I heard him on an English program of the Hanoi Radio.
Okay.
And I said, that must be Gong. His name was C-O-N-G. That must be Gong. I can recognize his voice. And it turned out that through connections, we found out that that was the guy I knew in England.
Wow.
He was responsible for the English broadcast of
Right. Did you ever get to meet up with any of them?
No, I couldn't. Because after I was released from prison in the North, I was sent back to Saigon right away. So I would have been able to contact them in Hanoi. Didn't have the opportunity.
Okay.
So that was amazing too.
In London, did you... This was in the early 1950s, mid-1950s. Did you hear of American rock and roll music, Elvis Presley, Chuck Berry, any of this?
Through the films, maybe.
Through the films,
yeah.
Okay.
But in England at that time, there was the first appearance of the mambo, cha-cha-cha, you know, Latin
uh-huh.
American things.
Uh-huh.
That was the influence also of Xavier Cugat and his orchestra,
uh-huh.
The one with the Chihuahua dog.
Uh-huh.
And that was the beginning of the craze at that time. They were Latin American.
Mm-hmm.
It was very very new to the British, you know, mambo
mm-hmm.
and cha-cha-cha and
mm-hmm.
these things. But as you know, as far as music is concerned, the British were still very much in the foxtrot, quick step type, you know,
mm-hmm.
maybe with their, tails
mm-hmm.
dancing in the big ballrooms. That's the British style.
So when you went to Oxford, did you find the curriculum challenging?
Very, very. And of course, that was completely different from what I had known up to there. Mm-hmm. You see, as you know, there they don't ask you what do you study, what do you read. Mm-hmm. So that implies that you read all the time.
Right.
And the system they ask, you know, they call it the tutorial system.
Right.
You have a tutor who would give you a subject each week to write. And the essay, traditionally, by customs, that you are supposed to read to him, you know, you meet him once a week, just you and him, mm-hmm. And then you are supposed to read your essay about half an hour, you see, and the remaining half, he would comment and discuss with you, mm-hmm. and that would go on like that, week after week, you see, so each term you have two, three tutors like that to cover mm-hmm. two or three subjects. Mm-hmm. You go on like that term after term. And as you know, you must have completed your minimum terms of residence. And it was very tough because, as you know, your name can only appear on the list of candidates for the examination only once in your life. And you are only allowed to present your application in the third year, that is to say at the 10th, 11th term, mm-hmm. to pass that exam, you know, the mm-hmm. four-year course, mm-hmm. then you are not allowed to present the application after the 12th or 13th term. That's too late for you, you know, unless you have a valid reason, you know, mm-hmm. broke your leg or something. if not, then you have to change subject and present yourself to another examination, but not the same examination twice. So you were given just one chance in your lifetime, you know.
Yeah.
That is why it's so tough. And then the collections every term. At the end of each term, you have the collection papers. And if you don't do well with your collection papers, they say goodbye to you. Mm. Very tough. I was told that, you know, for one guy who is there, accepted, admitted, about six or seven people waiting outside, you know, to take your bed there, while they were attending other universities, mm-hmm. London or something, mm-hmm. and you have to be careful.
How did that work?
You don't goof around.
How did you like that?
I liked it very much.
A lot of pressure.
Not, you know, and it is the whole atmosphere.
Right.
You have your bicycle, you run wild. And then you go to lectures, you listen to people, but most interesting was the activities. You know, you have to join various clubs in the mm-hmm. evenings. You are not supposed to goof around, but you have to join. If you are in philosophy, you have to join the club of the philosophers mm-hmm. and the engineers and so on and so forth. Mm-hmm. And the Oxford Debating Union Society there for the politicians, future politicians, mm-hmm. to play the games of Parliament, you know, right. they have there, you know that. Mm-hmm. And so that was very exciting, and they were very interested in, you know, those activities. I had the impression they were even more interested in those activities that you may, you know, carry out than your real studies.
Hmm. Which clubs were you a member of?
Oh, I was with the Oxford Union Debating Society,
yeah.
and then various clubs of literature and philosophy, and so on. I was attracted to the philosophers.
Mm-hmm. Which one did you enjoy the most of those clubs?
I think I enjoy all of them, because with friends you're all together, you see. Mm-hmm. It's not something that you were very aware of. You're drawn into those things. Mm-hmm. And then you'd have to participate in the students' newspapers and their writings
right.
and you know, all those things, you know.
Were there any other Vietnamese there at Oxford?
No, there was none at my time prior to me. There was one Vietnamese, that was Robert Dong, who was also a schoolmate in London. His father was Dr. Thong Van Dong, and he was in the early 50s, you know, he was in the mid 50s, I think, the Vietnamese ambassador in London. So that's why Robert was able to go to Oxford. But I think he stayed just a year. He didn't do well. So he went to Paris and graduated at the School of Political Science in Paris, mm-hmm. and became a diplomat of Saigon. Mm-hmm. Was with me at the Paris Peace Talks, And he was also the younger brother of General Tong Van Do, the one who overthrew Ngô Đình Diệm with Big Ming. So.
Right.
So he's now in Washington, D.C.
Okay. Would you like to take a break?
Okay. All right. So,
the Book of Merit.
Okay, so, Master Fong, let's talk about, if you will, some of the friends and acquaintances you made in England while you were there.
Well, of the friends, really friends that I had in England during my stay there, were, of course, Marika, whom I met at the French Institute. She was at the French Institute.
In London.
In London, when I was there. So, we would have the Book of America.
Okay.
Eventually, if you are interested. The other two great friends that I had was when I was at Oxford. They were roommates at the beginning. One was Tom Pendry. Tom Pendry.
P-E-N-D-R-Y.
Tom Pendry was a very nice looking guy. And he came from a very working class family. And he belonged to the something like Electrical Workers Union or something when he got the scholarship and went to Oxford as an adult student. And Tom Pendry used to wake us up in the morning with imitation of Frank Sinatra. Frank Sinatra. You know. And he sang very well too. Very nice guy. After our graduation in 1958, he went into politics. He married a very wonderful girl who became an alderman somewhere in the north of England. That is a kind of counselor, a municipal counselor. And he was then in politics and was elected to Parliament as the member of Parliament for the Labour Party. It was very Labour. Workers' Union.
Right.
And he stayed a member of Parliament for over 20 years. You know. The last time I talked to him and we met again when I was at the Paris Peace Talks, I went to London at the invitation of the House of Commons to give a presentation about the Paris Peace Talks, the positions that we took vis-à-vis the Vietnamese Communists and so on, Hanoi and the National Liberation Front. It was a very funny meeting that I had at the House of Commons because the Labour Party was a bit more inclined to the left and to the cause of the National Liberation Front of South Vietnam and so on. And after the presentation, there was very little intervention by the other MPs, questions and so on. And Tom said to me afterwards that we tried to support you, you know, because considered you as a friend, so we didn't ask many questions. And that's Tom Pendry. Eventually he became chairman of the Entertainment Committee or something of the House of Commons. He was responsible for the film industry and all these things, you know, and he enjoyed himself very much. But then it was also a sad story that his wife was in the north of England and he was in London most of the time. And he said to me, the marriage couldn't hold anymore. And I said, why? He said, well, we are so apart, and we're so apart. And besides, I have a new girlfriend, he said.
Okay.
And she's a film star. He was in the entertainment business.
Right.
So that was Tom Pendry, very good friend. The other one is John Mansley. He also, I think he was about a year younger than we were, but Tom Pendry after Oxford, went to work with the OECD in Paris.
So John or Tom?
John.
John,
yeah.
Okay.
The other one was the MP.
But
John Mensley joined the OECD, which is the Organization of Economic Cooperation and Development, which is the organization of all the capitalist countries, as you know. And he stayed there, you know, until the 80s. I think he retired now and live in Paris. And he married an Indian who was in Paris too. Very nice couple. But he was rather, you know, easy on the bottle. John Mensley, as a good Englishman.
Mm-hmm. You
know? But he was responsible for all these years for the G7 meetings, you know, and prepare. And he could call any president or prime minister to get the files ready for those G7, now G8 meetings. Quite a good guy. Still there. And I was very impressed when I saw him again in the late 60s when I was in Paris for the talks. He drove a Bentley.
Wow.
A vintage Bentley. They're really British. Much more than Tom Bentley. Much more conservative, so these were the two really good friends. There was another who was a very good friend too by the name of Michael O'Flanagan. He also got a scholarship from Ireland, and he was from a poor family, as most of those Irish who went there for further studies. Eventually, he became the chairman of the Economic Board of Ireland. So we were all economists. Did very well. But he said to me, he went to Paris to see me, and I was there for the talks. He was not very interested in politics, he was more of an economist. But he said something which touched me very much. That was by 68, 69, when we met again. After 10 years, you know. And he said, from whatever, you know, you are a marked man.
A marked man?
Yeah, that is to say, you have taken side. It was on the American side, you know, in that Vietnam War. So you say, whether you know, like it or not. And he knew me well, you know, kind of thinking I had. I've always been a very liberal guy, except anybody. With goodwill and sincerity. But I said, well, you have taken side. You are a madman. So whatever you may try to do, you have taken side. Sure, we have to.
Yeah.
So that was Michael O'Flanagan. Now coming to America, I met her at the French Institute, South Kensington. And we became friends right away.
How old was she? Was she your age?
She was exactly my same age. And she was born only 1 month after me. That is, the day I was born in February, she was born in March of the same year. What happened to her was that during the Second World War, her father was a university professor in Tallinn, the capital of Estonia. But they were under the Soviet Union, of course. So he was drafted and joined the Red Army and became a captain in the army. But he was a philosophy professor. And he just disappeared in those war years. So America was left home with her mother. You know, she was the only child of the couple. And then eventually, the German troops arrived, you know, they pushed up there. And then in the later part of the war, when the German army had to retreat under the pressure of the Soviet Red Army, they were used in the hundreds of thousands of people to be the human shield between them and the German and the Red Army. So with the retreat of the German forces, they end up, the mother and the daughter, in Berlin. So they went through the whole way down from Northern Europe down to Berlin.
Wow.
Didn't have anything to eat. People die every day around them. And she said that they even cut the rubber sole of their shoes to eat. They ate anything in the gutter, you see, wow, barefooted. But then they ended in Berlin at the end of the war, at the fall of Berlin. They were there. What happened to them was that the Red Cross took care of them, as most of those people. And they tried at that time to find out what happened to the father. They said, can't trace him anymore. And so the Red Cross took them to England as refugees. They were granted asylum in England. The mother then found a kind of work in a jewelry shop, didn't speak English. But Marika, by that time, was a kind of a polyglot. She spoke her own language to begin with. She spoke German. She spoke English, of course, when she was in England. She went to the French Institute. She spoke French. And was able, from the French, to understand Spanish and Italian.
Wow.
But she was really gifted for the languages, and she spoke French fluently, like a French girl. And she was not very good in maths. Good in languages, but very good in, not very good in maths. So I was the one who helped her with the maths problems.
Okay.
You know? And we were very close, and we were very young. We were 16, 17 at that time. And the mother liked me very much. They lived in the Harrow on the Hill, just a suburb of London. And very poor, of course, with some allowances and small job from the mother. And then in the Estonian community in England, in London, they had a kind of a eternal newspaper to have news from home in Estonia. And also what the Estonians were doing in England, you know. Bam! You know, they found them, got in contact. The father was alive, was also taken to England by the Red Cross. He tried to find his wife and daughter, couldn't find after the war. And so considered, they said that they disappeared during the war. You know, So he went to Exeter. She's in Cornwall, and became a gardener there. He didn't know much English. He married an English nurse.
Wow.
So they discovered that they were alive. So what happened was that at the suggestion of the mother, he agreed to move to London from Exeter with his English wife, the nurse, who found a job in England too. And they managed to find a house not too far away from the mother, so that Marika could then visit her father and be with her mother there. So we became very close, and on Sunday I would have lunch at the father's place with Marika, and then dinner on Sunday with the mother, and then I would return to my family, Mr. Brown, in London.
Right.
So when all like that, I became kind of part of the family. And, after those years, when we were about 20, that is when my brother left, went back home, then I made the decision to go to Oxford. And Marika then was looking for a job. Together we went to look for a job. So we went through the ads in the newspapers and so on. And there was an ad that a firm located in High Street, Kensington, needed a secretary. So which would know foreign languages and so on and so forth. So we went to that place, And we could even find the place because the address given there did not appear, you know, in the street.
Mm-hmm.
But at that place, there was a small, tiny alley used to take out the dustbins from the back.
Okay.
So we went into the alley, and in the back of the courtyard where they had all the dustbins there, there was a door leading you to a stair, you know, going up. And there was a small room with the name of the company there. And so we pushed the door, we went in, and we said that it's to, you know, respond to the ad offering a position of secretary for the company. So the guy who was there, sure, and then she asked Marika a few questions. He said, okay, you can do it, you know. What happened was those guys were involved in what they called cement additives. And all the three were also Oxford graduates.
Mm-hmm.
Two chemical engineers and one civil engineer. And they started their own company.
Mm-hmm.
Tiny hole in that, you mm-hmm. know, courtyard.
Mm-hmm.
And they started the cement additives. That is to say, the chemical things that you put when you prepare your mortars.
Mm-hmm.
That would give bubbles in it, colors,
mm-hmm.
or other kind of qualities that it would break, you know, slower,
mm-hmm.
less crispy, and things like that. They made a fortune. Eventually, they grew to over 400 workers.
Wow.
And Marika was involved in that growth because those three guys said that they had a factory outside in mm-hmm. the suburb, which turned out to be a garage. But they were very clever. They had, you know, beautiful literature printed to publicize the qualities of their cement additives and so on.
Mm-hmm.
They were so involved in the production, they began to sell, you know, those things and, to the construction mm-hmm. industry. And Marika, with her foreign languages, had also the habit of buying foreign newspapers, German, French, Italian, and mm-hmm. so on. And she, by herself, responded to the tender calls to build this and that all over the world.
Wow.
One, she had the response from the people who were building the Aswan Dam in Egypt.
Really?
Enormous thing.
Yes.
And then the airport in Beirut or something. And another one was the highways network in Germany. They said they would be interested in those cement additives.
Mm-hmm.
So she was the marketing,
mm-hmm.
you know, job in the group. And they said, well, they would be happy to talk to the experts in those things for the water. And they got the contracts of those three enormous things. That is, in a couple of years, they grew to about 400 people.
Mm-hmm.
You know. And those three guys were very good, too. They recognized the merit, you know, of the girl
mm-hmm.
to get those contracts for them.
Mm-hmm.
And so they share the equity in four. Gave her 25% of the company.
So she was able to build some wealth.
So she became very rich. During that time I was at Oxford,
mm-hmm.
still a poor student there, you know. And
Did you keep in touch with her?
All the time.
Okay.
You know, weekends she would go to Oxford or I would go to London. And
okay.
During the vacation mm-hmm. we would stay together. And so during my stay at Oxford there, the parents, the father and the mm-hmm. mother, said, well, Fong, are you thinking of, you know, marrying Rick? Because we would be very happy, you know. And she has bought a new house for the mother, a new house for the father and everything. And she had a wonderful apartment, you know, flat they call it.
Mm-hmm.
And she bought herself a sport car, Triumph. Small thing to go to work. So I was rather, you know, in the difficult position. But I held the line. was hard when you mix with those successful people. Mm-hmm. Although I was presented as a student at Oxford and so on. Mm-hmm. But they were very nice. They were in the business. I was rather in the academic thing, so it was okay. Mm-hmm. But of course, when it came to pick up the bills, she was the one. Even for her spare pocket money, that would pay for my studies.
Right.
And she bought a Ming vase and put cash in there, £5 notes in there, and she said, "That is pocket money." That pocket money would see me through a year mm-hmm. at Oxford. Mm-hmm. And so that was the situation. That was the hard situation. But I held the line, for the sake of bottles. That lasted until the end of 1959, when I said, I also had sufficient time at Oxford. And my mother also was missing me, and that was the moment when I had to make a choice, get a job, and start, and also marry Marika. Mm-hmm. But then it turned out that my parents wanted me to return, and father managed to get a job in Saigon with the foreign ministry, that it would be a very good job, things like that. But it turned out that by the end of 1959, I was invited to have a lunch mm-hmm. With George P. Case, who was the general manager of Stanwack in Saigon.
Okay.
So Stanwack was kind of a joint venture mm-hmm. between SO Standard in New Jersey, mm-hmm. Standard Oil New Jersey, and Mobile.
Right.
So eventually, in the early of 1960, we agreed, Marika and I, that I would go home, pick up the job with the SO people, and eventually, we get married and so on.
Okay.
Yeah.
So you would move back to Saigon and take a job with Esso.
Yes.
And then she was going to join you in Saigon?
That's what we thought.
Okay.
That, if I don't like it in Saigon, I will return to London. At that time, I was also offered a job by the European Common Market in Brussels.
Okay.
That was the beginning thing, because I wrote a paper on the European Common Market at that time, that is, try to have projections to see whether it would be better for England to join the European Common Market or the free trade area with the mm-hmm. Scandinavian countries, which mm-hmm. would be much more Anglo-Saxon mm-hmm. type, mm-hmm. And it turned out that I came to the conclusion that it would be better for Britain. I looked through the automobile industry into machine tools and all those things, and I came to the conclusion with the Duns at Oxford that it would be, in the long run, more beneficial to Britain to join the European Common Market rather than stay at the free trade area with the Scandinavian countries and so on. So maybe that paper impressed the people of the European Common Market in Brussels, where they have their seat there, and they offered me a job.
Okay.
But I think in the end, I was drawn by the fact that I had to see my parents again and wait so long and so on and so forth.
Mm-hmm.
And it was a good job at SO too, so mm-hmm. I decided to go back. But it was a tough thing too. The decision was very tough. Because I must say that till the last minute, before I took the plane back to Saigon, Marika had hoped, I'm sure, that I would remain in England.
Mm-hmm.
But that was hard for me. And I was still a young guy of 24 years old. I thought that, I had the duty to go home to my parents. And then after that, I could always return to England any time. Mm-hmm. So that was the state of mind.
You were the youngest son?
Yes, so last one.
You still felt the duty to go back to your
parents? Yes, very much.
Even though your older brother was already there?
Yes, very much. Okay.
Were you homesick a lot for Vietnam while you were in Paris, London, and Oxford?
Very often.
Yeah?
Very often.
What kind of communication did you have?
Letters.
Just letters?
Letters. We didn't have much telephone at that time.
Right. So. Okay. Before we transition back to Saigon, what were your thoughts on the French war in Vietnam while you were in England?
I didn't think much, but I was very much aware during my stay at Oxford mm-hmm. about the conflict between communism mm-hmm. and the capitalism.
The Cold
War. Western world. I think at that time we didn't use much the term Cold War. I think in the 50s, the mid-50s, I think the term Cold War came much later.
Okay.
But I was really interested in those aspects because I think in 67 or something, if I'm not mistaken about the date, we had the Spring of Prague, mm-hmm. you see. And at Oxford, we took in about 17 students, you know, refugees from Prague. And I became conscious, you know, of the problems of communism, because I was really interested in philosophy mm-hmm. and particularly in ethics, in the philosophy of religions. Mm-hmm. I had friends with the religious circles there a lot when I was at Oxford. I was with the Catholics, you know, that is the, I think that was the Newman Society. And then I had friends with the Dominicans. They had a college called the Black Friars. I took philosophy courses there with them. And the Cray Friars, that's another college of the Franciscans.
Okay.
And then you had also Campion Hall. That is the Anglicans, you know. So I had friends in all those religious groups, mm-hmm. and they teased me, you know, very often that I was the most Christian among the pagans. And that was it. I was very influenced by the Christian, you know, thoughts, and I became aware of the problem of communism. And the problem of communism to me was, first of all, their rejection of the individual. That was the very first impression I had. The second thought which came to me about communism was that the system couldn't be workable. You know, and my own Don and tutor, Joe Kerwin, Joseph R. Kerwin, mm-hmm. Told me something which you know, impressed me very much. They, you cannot plan the hands how many eggs to give every day, you know, to give to your people. There are things you cannot plan that way. You know, how many hats per year, how many umbrellas per year, how many hens per year, you know. Mm-hmm. And I was never really impressed by the socialist doctrine, really. But I crowned them, you know, in inverted commas, the sincerity of their ideals of social justice, mm-hmm. of brotherhood, love among nations, and things like that. But I also had the impression that, I mean, ideals like that is not the monopoly, you know, of the communist ideology. They are ideals, you know, at all times for everybody, everywhere in the world, you know. But to make it into a political system and then impose your values on the people mm-hmm. in the name of social justice, I didn't believe in it. because that wouldn't be, realistic, considering the human nature, what human beings are. So that was, a very short impression of the whole thing.
One of the criticisms of Marx is that he really leaves out the individual, that he forgets this part of the equation that, the individual can make his or her own decisions, his or her own passions, their choices and vocation, and that to put them in a system squelches that.
And that is where, Jean-Jacques Rousseau came in again in my mind. Mm-hmm. That is, say, granted, your ideas of social justice and all these things. But then, to understand it, mm-hmm. In the historical context, I was able to understand, Marxism, socialism, communism came out in a certain historical context with the Industrial Revolution, mm-hmm. with the abuse of labor, mm-hmm. and all those things. But it is not because of that historical context that you can, reduce a person to a number, and deny, other aspects of his human dignity, mm-hmm. of, his rights as individuals.
Right.
And I was, impressed by the sentence of Jean-Jacques Rousseau that maybe you have to force people to be free. That's rather difficult. But I had, very good lessons from George B. H. Cole, who was at Old Souls College, and he was teaching political theory and political thoughts. And he was one of the authority on Marxism. Mm-hmm. He was a Marxist himself. Mm-hmm. He was with the Webs. That is to say, he belonged to what we would refer to the second and a half international. Okay. That is, from the socialist thinking, moved to the third international of Lenin. Mm-hmm. They refused to join Lenin, mm-hmm. and his methods, and his interpretation of Marxism. And maybe they claim it's not the right time yet to move to communism. Mm-hmm. And that kind of so-called dictatorship of the proletariat, mm-hmm. of the working class, and that overcome the dilemma of the oppressed and the oppressors, and so on and so forth. Mm-hmm. So I was very impressed by George Cole, and in a way, you can say that I am a bit influenced by that Marxist thinking, mm-hmm. but I would go all the way, because it wouldn't be valid in my mind for the reasons I just said. Mm-hmm. But it came out, the whole thing, of a certain historical context with the Industrial Revolutions in England, right. and so on and so forth. You have to defend the interests and the rights of the workers, mm-hmm. but not to make it an ideology and call it as a historical interpretation of the struggle between the oppressed and the oppressors. Oh, that is too far-fetched for me. And whatever system that you that I thought would work is that you must have, first of all, the respect of the individual, because I was probably influenced very heavily by family values, and to me the family is the most basic, so is a cell of society, mm-hmm. and if you deny that sense of the family, mm-hmm. as the Maoists would do later on, as you can see, complete rejection of that notion of family unit and so on, then you fail. You fail because you are against the very nature of man. So that was my, very youthful way of thinking at that time.
Okay. Yeah. So back in Vietnam, the French are and the Vietnamese are fighting while you're in England.
Yes, but by that time, there is also the end of the French period, mm-hmm. with the Geneva mm-hmm. Accords in 1954-55. Mm-hmm. Then in Vietnam moved into the second phase with President Ngo Dinh Diem, the overthrow of Emperor Bao Dai, the mm-hmm. declaration of the Republic, and so on. So we began at that time. But I was not very aware of things, what was happening in Vietnam, only through the newspapers and so on and so forth. But it came slowly into the notion of the conflict between ideologies. See, without knowing very much about those ideologies, what capitalism was really, or mm-hmm. communism was really. Mm-hmm. See, but more and more, I was drawn to think that communism is has an international vocation. You see, mm-hmm. and so maybe it will spread. Mm-hmm. But I didn't understand it really yet.
Right. Okay. Any of your classmates, were they aware or more aware of what was happening in your country? And did they bring this to your attention?
Not at all.
No?
I think they didn't have any interest in those things. They were much more interested in the British problems and okay. so on and so forth.
Okay.
And much more practical there. But that seems to be a bit far away, you know. We had the impression there was some problem in the Soviet Union, so-called Soviet Union at that time.
Mm-hmm.
You see, but I don't think that people were much aware at that time, in the mid-50s or in the 60s, what communism was, really. I don't think so. Really.
Okay.
And I doubt very much that people in the Soviet Union at that time behind the Iron Curtain were also aware
mm-hmm.
of what Lenin and Stalin was doing to them.
Right.
Were doing to them.
Right.
They just accepted life, which was very hard after the Second World War. I mean, whether you like it or not, I mean, the Russians took probably the hardest blow of the Second World War.
Mm-hmm. Yes. Can you describe how you felt returning to Vietnam?
When you went back in 1960? Mm-hmm. And also a bit proud, you know, to return home,
mm-hmm.
not as a lame duck, and then was given a very good job. Very well-paying job. See, I earned something at that time about four times a colonel. With ESO, my salary was about four times more than the salaries of a colonel at that time, mm-hmm. a director in a ministry. So,
how much do you remember? How much you were paid?
$200,000 a month or something of that kind.
Okay.
Why a director at the Ministry of the Foreign Affairs, where I was supposed to have a job,
mm-hmm.
My father managed to find a place there for a position there for me, was making about $50,000. So, free enterprise. And with the largest company in the world, ESO.
Right. How did your father feel about you not taking the foreign ministry job and
Oh, he was happy, whatever decision I made, but they were happy to have me back to begin with.
Right, yes. Right. And so your first day on the job was April 16th, 1960?
I think April or June or something,
okay.
about that, yes.
Okay.
Yeah, that was before the summer of 1960 anyway,
okay.
I remember. So.
Right, right. How did you describe, you were in Saigon. Yeah.
Well, I returned and then took a few days off because I promised George Case that I will report to work as soon as
mm-hmm.
I returned to Saigon. And I began the job right away. And when I started at ESO, the general manager, Mr. Case, then put me on an executive training program.
Mm-hmm.
Which is it would last for 2 years. So you see, the ESO people, they were really good mm-hmm. in training their executives.
Mm-hmm.
So I was there as an executive trainee.
Okay.
There were two of us. And we started there. And then I rotated during 2 years in all the departments. And so I think we started with the operations department, that is the technical mm-hmm. aspect of the business. And so I went to the oil depots, you know, mm-hmm. reception of the tankers coming in,
mm-hmm.
and then distribute the products, and so on and so forth, and even the refueling airplanes at the airport. And then afterwards I was moved to the sales department, that is to say, learn how people sell kerosene and gasoline mm-hmm. and the service stations, mm-hmm. how to set up those things. And after the sales department, I was then put to the finance accounting to learn how to keep the books
mm-hmm.
and so on. And I went then to the human resources, you know, the organization of manpower and so on and so forth. And in the end of the two-year program, end up with the general manager's office. You see the total coordination, economic coordination of the whole business. Mm-hmm. And so by that time, that would be about 62 or something, 62, 63. There was the problem with the Petroleum Workers Union. They demanded all kinds of things, salary, wages, increases, and things like that. Mm-hmm. And by that time, that George Case said that, why don't you join them at the Human Resources, which they could be personnel department, and give them a hand on the negotiations with the workers' union. So that's why I joined and the negotiations in about 63, 62, 63, which that lasted for 2 years. And it became, I mean, the negotiation industry-wide with Shell and Cantex. Mm-hmm. And so I conducted those negotiations on the management side, of course, mm-hmm. With the workers' union there. For 2 years, we drafted the first collective agreement industry-wide in Vietnam history. And then we signed that by, I think, 64, mm-hmm. or beginning 65, which then became the model right away for the plantation workers and the banks. Mm-hmm. So they took our model, adapted to their industries, and they signed the following two collective agreements of Vietnam. Okay. There were three collective agreements by 1965 in Vietnam. So I knew well the workers' unions, mm-hmm. you know, and the people at the labor ministry, mm-hmm. and the leaders there. And it was tough negotiations, but everybody was happy. So I was also very proud, because at that very young age, and I conducted very tough negotiations, mm-hmm. on a very friendly basis, mm-hmm. and they were very happy, because those oil companies, with Shell and Cantex and Esso, I mean, all the big shots were foreign expatriates, and they were happy to find someone in me, mm-hmm. who could, you know, talk to them first of all, mm-hmm. More or less fluently, mm-hmm. and understand them, and be able in Vietnamese to deal with the Vietnamese workers' unions.
Right.
And so that was a tough job for them to find someone that, and they were happy that I was, you know, instrumental in the negotiations.
Did you feel like that you had found a really good place?
I was very happy, because that was the first time that I did anything really practical besides academic work.
Right, right. Okay. And did you see yourself staying with Esso?
In
the private sector?
Yeah, sure. I was very interested in their retirement plan.
Okay. Can you? We're almost out of time here on this disc. I want to ask you one other question before we have to switch discs. Can you describe Saigon at this time? You came back in 1960.
Yeah. So in the 1960s, there was not much fighting. Uh-huh. You can travel. You could travel day and night. I mean, I used to drive from Saigon to Da Lat, for example. I drove even at night. Hmm. So without much fear. Mm-hmm. You all been, you know, attacked or something. There was, say, subversive actions, mm-hmm. but scattered. Mm-hmm. And like in the late 40s and even in the 50s, mm-hmm. you know, the resistance movements were in a position only to have kind of sabotage work, mm-hmm. or even to, how do you call it, you know, reprisals, mm-hmm. against the Vietnamese who were not in the Viet Minh ranks or in the communist ranks.
You're talking about the Viet Cong in the south doing this?
So at that time, I think we started to use the expression Viet Cong.
Okay.
Yeah, and President Ngo Dinh Diem pleased himself to call them the communist pirates, rather, you know, Tong Fei, which means the highway brigands and robbers and things like that. And so, which was the way he labeled them. But they blew up movie houses and markets and killed the village chiefs and so on. So. And that it was not the fashion to use the term at that time, but they were terrorists. They used acts of terrorism. That is the way of fighting, which would lead you to reassess your concept of warfare. That was the beginning. No one was aware very much that terrorism would be a way of fighting. That was the beginning.
Were you fearful in Saigon?
I was not. I had a good job with a large American, powerful American company, well paid, had my car, you know, company car.
Right.
And I lived with my parents, so had a good life, but very busy because of that period. It was extremely busy. And I was not much aware of what the Saigon government doing. Not that they were, you know, there, the authority. Mm-hmm. They had to deal with some kind of you know, resistance from the communists. And President Goh Ding Yim claimed to be the apostle of the free world. We had the beginning of the American presence more and more every day. But I was so busy with other things that I didn't pay attention to those things. And the first clash that I had with the regime was a very funny incident.
Before we get into, sorry, before we get into that, let me change this disc out, okay? Ambassador Fong and I are going to stop the second session of our interview today, and we will resume tomorrow at 9 a.m. Thank you, sir.